Today on Against the Grain, how should we understand the historical and ideological roots of the widespread crisis of nature? Historian of science David Kubrin argues that in the midst of great popular social upheaval, the scientific revolution displaced older, pagan ideas that nature was a living force. The consequences, he argues, were deep and long-lasting, including on what would become Marxism, ultimately dampening its power to change the world. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The scientific revolution that took place in the 17th century fundamentally shifted how Europeans viewed the world. And no one more than Isaac Newton, the English mathematician, astronomer, and physicist, epitomized the new way of seeing the natural world, not as a living thing, but as a machine. But historian of science David Kubrin argues that Newton's own views were much more complex, shaped in part by his own practice of alchemy. In his book, Marxism and Witchcraft, published by Autonomedia, David Kubrin posits that the mechanistic outlook molded the ideas of the modern capitalist period, including those of Karl Marx. And he argues that the animistic ideas of popular culture were lost to society's detriment. David, the scientific revolution turned the world on its head. What social changes took place in the centuries preceding it that led up to that epical shift?
It's the axis of the modern world around which it turned. I don't distinguish between the onset of these various forces, but for starters, colonialism rears its ugly head at the end of the 15th century and the conquest. And that is rapidly followed by a industrialization of slavery. Not that slavery is new, but all of a sudden it's on a world scale, an oceanic trade. Capitalism is identical with resource extraction. And therefore, with resource extraction, you have devastating impacts upon the natural world. And then around that same time and connected to that is the war of terror against women called the witchcraft craze. But the important thing also is in dead center in that period and connected with it is the first wholesale rebellion against a major monarchy that succeeds. There had been hundreds, probably thousands of rebellions and insurrections across Europe in the lead up to modernity. But England pulls it off and for 12 years is no longer a monarchy. And the upper house of parliament was abolished, censorship ended, there were demands for women to get into Cambridge and Oxford. There was a wholesale revolution and a taking of power and an execution of the king, and the Church of England was abolished. But at the radical end of that rebellion, and a very important radical end, the Levellers, the Diggers, and a whole bunch of others, were claims that the origin of sin was private property and that the role of women had to be reexamined both in terms of sexuality and in terms of power, and that land was to be returned to the commons that was in the process of being taken away. So it's a roiling social landscape. And issues that we think of as only arising in the 1848 Seneca Falls were out there in this period, in the 17th century. Women's rights were a big issue. Anti-slavery was a big issue in some quarters. So it's an exciting time.
Several decades later in England, Isaac Newton, the English mathematician, physicist, and astronomer, publishes his most influential works. And I wonder if you can remind us of how he shifted the prevailing view of how the universe works, and how influential was his thinking?
I don't think you can overestimate his thinking. Isaac Newton basically becomes the doorway into modernity. Once you teach the new science to your people, you were beginning to bring them into the Western fold worldwide. And I'm going to critique that transition, but I don't want people to think I'm anti-science. I'm anti the metaphors that come along with a scientific theory. And in this case, they were devastating metaphors. Newton succeeded in explaining the workings of the solar system and how gravity affected that and how light is bent to form rainbows. And he, along with Leibniz, invented the calculus. And he didn't do all this single-handed. He built on a tradition, of course. There are continuities, but his kind of the epitome. But the important thing that I go into is from Newton, we get the notion that the universe is a machine. And the biologists eventually extended that to the body as a machine. And the governments extended that to government as a machine. And we live in a worldview that started in the 17th century that began with literally disbelieving the lifefulness of nature. There was a deanimation of nature because it all became a machine run according to law and order and cause and effect. And the law and order is no metaphor here. The people inventing this new worldview connected it to a desire to put down the widespread social insurrections that were taking place across the face of Europe. They literally said, when they talked about the importance of the new law of inertia, this will put down the rabble. And there was a war against the rabble because the rabble were rousing across the face of Europe. In England, they succeeded for a while. But it was important on all sorts of levels for people suddenly to see the world as dead and as a machine. Number one, resource extraction. Destroyed meadows were everywhere because of the upsurge in mining technology. Devastating. And people saw it. Against that, you posit a world of dead matter, which is what inertia means. And it's harder to mourn, you know, when a river is ruined if it's already made of dead matter. Dead matter also was just a total negation of Native American and African beliefs in the lifefulness of the world, on which their cultures and their healing traditions and their concept of the cyclical nature of time were based. Their whole mythology was based on a living nature. And surprisingly also, a living nature was the fundamental worldview of the rabble-rousers at the time. The critics of the rabble-rousers, the men of, and yeah, mainly men of property and the clergy, et cetera, in reaction to the insurrectionary mood where churches were being torn down and land was being seized and fencing was being destroyed and women were having the nerve to get up and preach. The people against that made the very explicit point that the leaders that they were having to repress were followers of a magical tradition. And that had to be suppressed through a widespread campaign that involved language reform, music reform, religious reform, and a transformation of the way people saw nature. That's the scientific revolution. What I go into in the book is Newton, the father of that, the architect of that, fundamentally did not believe it.
Well, let me ask you about that. So you say that the Newton that we know, the Newton of this revolutionary shift in how the world is seen toward a mechanistic view of the universe and its sort of inhabitants as following these laws, these mechanical laws, that Newton is only part of the story. That in fact, there were two Newtons. And you started this work, I believe, on a Guggenheim Fellowship into newly available material written by Isaac Newton that shone a light on a very different side of his work. Can you tell us about that other side?
It's becoming widely known now in the past decade. More books have been published, which point out that Newton was a practicing alchemist. That's been known for some decades, actually, but it's only becoming popular knowledge recently. The important thing about alchemy is it's based on the notion that the universe is alive. And the alchemical quest, which people think of as, you know, trying to turn base metals into gold, but it's more than that. It was a spiritual undertaking that was fundamentally a healing process. And the reagents that they sought to make were healers and were quite successful healers in a number of instances, according to evidence I've found. And there was also the transformation of lesser materials into gold. But though many of the practitioners were into that transformation that they sought for monetary reasons, it was really a spiritual sign that you had mastered the powers of creation. And that arrogance of mastering the powers of creation made alchemy in the 17th century a very subversive, politically, spiritually, medicinally, a very subversive enterprise. So recent literature has alluded to the fact that Newton was an alchemist, but they missed the point entirely, which is his alchemy totally negated the what we see of as his physics, based on inert matter. Matter's not inert. Newton knew it, and he wrote it, but then he crossed it out and wouldn't let it be printed. I've found, I think, four instances where he says something. This is a direct quote, but the others are variants. Thus, we cannot say matter is not everywhere alive. Well, that's not Newton, the machine universe. That's not Newton, the law of inertia. That's a different Newton. And since Newton is the gateway into modernity, that hidden part of our history has totally transformed the way we live. All of our society is based on the mechanistic premise, everything. The social sciences, English even, you know, theology in some sense, follow upon the heels of this rational explosion of explanation that seems to embody the scientific revolution. This also is the green light to ecocide. If nature is dead, then we've lost the battle. And that was used consciously.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm joined by historian of science, David Kubrin, and we're talking about the history of the shift in Europe with the advent of capitalism to a mechanistic view of the world and its implications for nature and for all of us centuries later. I wanted to ask you then about, to stay a moment, David, with the period that we're discussing and the social changes that Europe was undergoing in a really thoroughgoing way. I mean, you mentioned that the ability to extract resources was accelerating during this period because, of course, this was the time of the rise of capitalism. And it was also the time of the witch hunts. And as you note in your book, Marxism and Witchcraft, many scholars look at this period with some befuddlement and say, how is it that at a time of the scientific revolution, which questioned irrational thinking, why did the witch hunts happen then rather than earlier in times of, you know, dark irrationality? So tell us about how you understand the witch hunts and the larger forces of capitalism as it was emerging.
Well, I want to first give a shout out to Silvia Federici, who also delves into this so-called mystery and her work, particularly in Caliban and the Witch. But what I think the two of us are chasing is this new understanding of the witches as a barrier for the onset of capitalism because of their rootedness in the countryside and a population that, though nominally Christian, still has a whole tradition of pagan belief and worship and ritual going back millennia that has a veneer of Christianity on it, a sincere Christianity, but is also still alive. And the witch hunts are an attempt to first put women in their place, because women then, as women now, are metaphorically identified with nature, and nature is undergoing an incredible assault under the forces of colonialism and embryonic capitalism. And it's a first salvo, I think, in the war against the peasantry, or maybe not the first, but an important one, that singles out women, because women were, this is a total conjecture, but throughout history, women has been at the forefront of ecological fights. Roy in India, Love Canal, Rachel Carson, Karen Silkwood, all the people we think of in terms of environmental fights most are women. And I'm surmising that was the case back then, because there were rebellions in the countryside, a tearing down of the fences of enclosure. And in all likelihood, women were at the forefront of that. There may be evidence for that. I haven't found it. So the war against, and one of my objections, and I assume Sylvia's also, is witch hunt has become a synonym for chasing after imaginary things. And the same scholars who have no doubt that they're practicing witches in Africa or brujas in Latin America seem to find it incredulous to think that any such should have sullied the landscape of early modern Europe. Nonsense. There were women in the countryside who healed, who prophesied, who did spells, who worked with nature, who conducted moon rituals, who midwifed, etc. They existed, and they became a target as part of the transition to modernity, literally to put women in their place through a war of terror.
So then, obviously, your critique of this, of the way the Enlightenment was used to justify the emergence of capitalism in early modern Europe, and Isaac Newton played an important role in that shift. You write that what came to dominate was a particular school of thought within the scientific revolution. And I wanted to ask you if there were other aspects of the Enlightenment that you see as not having that same sort of noxious effect.
Well, there are always counter voices, absolutely. At the same time as you have the 18th century Industrial Revolution and the mercantile capital taking over and the English Empire roaring across the planet, you also have a William Blake. You have the Romantic reaction against that and a critique. So dialectics is always in progress, but we tend to not appreciate the meaning of that dialectic and what the contending forces were.
Well, staying with that notion of the dialectic, but moving forward several centuries, I wanted to ask you about the philosopher Hegel. Hegel, again, a pivotal figure in Western thought, certainly enormously influential on the work of Karl Marx, but not only on Marx. And the idea of the dialectic, although it has its roots in antiquity, it's very much shaped by him. Can you tell us a bit about who Hegel was and from where he drew his notion of the dialectic?
Well, one of the things I go into in the book is Hegel got his notion of the dialectic out of popular culture, and also from learning about the I Ching, I believe. But he made it into an academic, very formal, very mechanistic way. Thesis, antithesis, resolution. Thesis, antithesis, resolution. Which is a living logic dialectic should not be. But it's quite clear where Hegel got his notion. If you look at his lectures on the history of philosophy, where people who we see as pivotal for the onset of rational thinking, like Descartes or Hobbes or Locke are given scant analysis in comparison with Giordano Bruno and Tommaso Campanella and many of the people coming out of the natural magic tradition or the peasant tradition. Jacob Boehme, all important figures, and that's who is really important to Hegel, and that's who he spends his time in his lectures analyzing. But Hegel, as a member or representative of the Junker class in Germany, Hegel needs to tame the dialectic. He says it himself that the earlier dialectic was too filled with enthusiasm. Enthusiasm was a code word back then for uppity people, for rebels, for the type of people who tear down walls or desecrate churches. So Hegel consciously set out to tame the dialectic, and unfortunately, I think, with some exceptions, because Marx was also aware of Jacob Boehme, the 16th century alchemist, and wrote about him. But with some exception, Marx gets his dialectics from an already denatured version of it, torn from its history, long history of rebellion, stretching way, way back.
Well, tell us a bit more about that, David. So for people who aren't familiar with the idea of dialectics, it's a way of understanding the dynamism of contradictions in society and history, in social change. Tell us more about how Hegel drew his notion of dialectics, although, as you say, he sort of later stripped it bare, from popular magic. How was dialectics being harnessed in that sort of thinking?
The yin-yang symbol is a nice way of looking at it, how things turn into their opposite, and how what is minuscule today can become overwhelming tomorrow through that process of change. And that in every situation, there exists a contradiction which may grow to overwhelm and take over that entity. And those were powerful understandings to a powerless people, you know, taking on the crown and the lords and property in the English Civil War.
Did alchemy play a particular role in that dialectic?
Absolutely. There was a group, or maybe a not group, it's legendary. The sources are sparse. I believe they existed, but there's scholars who say, no, it was just a... And they called themselves the Rosicrucians. They're the forebears of today's Rosicrucians. I'm not quite sure how much continuity there is, but there was a series of anonymous pamphlets published in the early part of the 17th century that tore into the soul of Europe and scared the bejesus out of the ruling circles, but not the intelligentsia. It was a group that said that the new understanding of the world should be pursued by a combination of several elements, but key to it was alchemy. And it was to gather information and share information, much of it coming out of the Islamic Middle East and magic. And its purpose was to heal people, but to heal people for free and to heal people anonymously. The Rosicrucian seer was not to wear a garb and certainly not to charge any money. It was to be a force to increase the livelihood of everyone, not just the royalty and the nobility and the aristocracy and the wealthy, the bankers, and many of the intelligentsia were fascinated by these pamphlets and tried to contact this group. There is evidence that Descartes was in contact with them. But the church was really scared because the Philosopher's Stone, this emblem of having accomplished the great goal of transformation, was compared to Jesus Christ by some of the alchemists. It was sacrilege, and it denied the prerogatives of property. So when the reaction against the insurgents in England took place, by men of property and philosophers who said this is too much. Almost to a man, the writers claimed that the enthusiasts, the insurgents, were alchemists, and many of them were. And I maintain that believing in the lifefulness of nature and the lifefulness of matter gives you impetus to work with it and to play with it and to shape it. And that was important to the insurgents.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with historian of science David Kubrin. We're discussing his book, Marxism and Witchcraft, which is published by Atana Media. You can find a link to Marxism and Witchcraft at againstthegrain.org. So I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Marx earlier, and of course the influence of Hegel on Marx. Can you tell us the context of the early 19th century critique by the young Hegelians who were followers of Hegel, who then broke from him and his conservatism, his justification for the Prussian state, and they rejected Newtonian mechanistic and reductionistic thinking. Can you tell us about the ideas of that time and their influence on the young Karl Marx?
Well, he was a, you know, card-carrying member, as they said in the McCarthy period, of the young Hegelians. And Hegel was the rising star of that anti-mechanistic understanding, that spiritual understanding based on a so-called ideal. And the young Hegelians were not comfortable with the conservative point of view that their master represented and started to use it as a critique of society, of German society, which should be understood was not as capitalistic, not as industrialized at that point as England and France. England was and France was becoming. But they critiqued society primarily through the lens of religion. They started analyzing belief in the Bible or what it was based on and the evidence for Christianity and using that as a way of undermining what religion was the base of, which was the 19th century German society. And Marx came into his fullness critiquing their critique because he said it's not enough to critique the religious basis of society. We need to change things. But that was his background. And it's important to know that these questions of the dialectic and how things change were very important. In fact, Marx's doctoral dissertation at the University of Jena was a comparison of the two ancient Greek sources of atomism in terms of which one was mechanistic and which one had a possibility of freedom inherent in it. That was his doctoral dissertation. And at the center is the question of how things change. How things change is very important. In mechanistic thinking, things change because something on the outside affects them. Something impinges on them. As a billiard ball changes, rams into another one, and sends it off on a different trajectory. That is the notion of how transformation occurs in a mechanistic thinking society. And we live in such a society, and it permeates everything we do and think and feel. But if change is internal, you get a total different picture of it.
Indeed, and I guess, you know, one of the points of your book is that these are not, you're arguing, obscure philosophical questions, but how we see the world, how we see nature, whether it is a living thing, whether it is dead, how we see social change, whether it follows mechanical laws or comes from within, say within, you know, real human beings. These all have political implications, and therefore you're arguing that these ideas have a bearing on the present. And I guess partly what you're arguing is that although you have a criticism of Marxism as it relates to mechanistic thinking in some parts of Marx's work, that much of it came out of this Naturphilosophie, this idea of a non-mechanistic, non-reductionistic way of seeing the world. Is that right?
Yes. And I go on to argue that Marx's gradual seduction into mechanistic thinking as he matured had a serious effect on the revolutionary movement that grew up in his name, because to a considerable degree it began operating and thinking and assuming within that mechanistic mold.
Mm-hmm. And to be clear, your argument here, as you state in your book, is not an anti-Marxist one in the sense of, you know, a right-wing attack on Marxist thinking, but instead that you yourself have been deeply influenced by Marxism and yet have also seen the limitations and contradictions of it.
Yes. I start my book with a class analysis of the role of the shaman and witches, their social role in production as a good Marxist. And what I come up with is a contradiction of Marx and Engels' critique of religion. So I'm definitely rooted in that tradition, but I also grew painfully aware as a Marxist activist in revolutionary organizations in the 70s and 80s particularly, but even in the 60s, how little interest Marxist organizations that I was involved with took in ecological questions. Those were not the real concerns of the working class, they falsely believed. Totally ignorant of the, for example, of environmental racism.
And yet, you also argue in your book that Marx had his own connections, whether distant or not, to occult thinkers, which I think comes as a surprise for many readers. Can you tell us about that?
You know, it came to me recently. Of course he did, because he ran in bohemian somewhat circles. And he would know the oddballs of his time. But the oddballs of his time, many of them socialists of some form or other, or ex-socialists, were also some of the leading mystics of his time. Floris Tristan, who was the first one to put forth the notion, I believe, although hard to believe that late, of a workers' union. She was an associate. The leading exponent of magic in the 19th century, a man who styled himself the Abbe Constant, was a good friend of Marx. I think Bakunin was interested in alchemy. And as I said, Marx read Jacob Bremer, the 16th century alchemical radical, and was influenced by him. So Marx was, looking at these traditions and critical of mechanical thinking, although I argue that eventually he succumbed to it, particularly after 1848.
After the failure of the revolutions of 1848. Historian of science David Kubrin is my guest. We're discussing his book, Marxism and Witchcraft. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in your book, Marxism and Witchcraft, which I should say is enormously wide-ranging, you also see the ways that these traditions, the tradition of a mechanistic view of the world, of nature, which Isaac Newton most particularly represented, but which was central to the advent of capitalism, that we see those ideas in full force in our time when capitalism spans the entire globe. And I wanted to ask you about how you connect that mechanistic thinking to the 20th century and into the 21st computer revolution, which, as you note, is a revolution that many people have seen take place in their own lifetimes.
Absolutely. We straddle both worlds. And while the digerati among us have illusions, important illusions, that they are transcending mechanism, it's actually a deepening of mechanism. obviously seen in something like biotech, where the, you know, like the hot rodder in his driveway, souping up his car with a new carburetor. They're shifting the so-called genes back and forth to ridiculous arrogance, totally ignorant of the principles of life. There's a man down at Stanford, for example, who is developing bio bricks, little building blocks of life, he thinks. And he believes that eventually using bio bricks, instead of planting a tree and cutting the wood and building a bookcase, you can have a tree that builds itself into a bookcase. Reductionistic thinking that is infantile in its stupidity. The notion of artificial intelligence, for example, total oxymoron. How do you have intelligence that is without consciousness? It doesn't exist. It's a statistical method they use for making predictions, and it's very powerful in some instances, and also very misleading, as in photo surveillance identification in others. But the computer so-called revolution is a reductionistic, everything is reduced to zeros or ones. That tells it all, and that has an effect on how we understand the world. If everything is zeros or ones, the world is totally mechanistic. There are no either or. There are no and buts. There are no transitions of the one into the other. It is a static entity. The pixel is either filled or empty. The tone is in the recording is either present or absent. And it's a furthering of that mechanistic understanding. And for many of the same reasons, the mechanism of the 17th century gets imposed on a population that's unruly and insurgent. And the computer revolution, very interestingly, and there are close ties, as Ted Zrozek showed so well, between people scared out of their minds of what's happening in the 60s as the anti-war movement confronted the state, and as CS gas and clubs and water cannons start getting deployed, there was a bunch of the activists, SCS activists, who decided instead of liberating ourselves by going up against the state, we should go off into cyber worlds where we can be masters of our own domain. And if you look at the history of Silicon Valley, it's filled with such thoughts, including Steve Jobs, for example, who constantly emphasized how what he was doing was revolutionary. It was the theme of every sales pitch, every conference, every new product he brought forth. And he played so you say you want a revolution at his product launches. It was a bait and switch. Instead of fighting the state and fighting corporations, we'll develop these new machines that will empower everyone, and everyone can become much more powerful in these domains. And this was a conscious, on the part of some people, including Jobs, this is a conscious bait and shift.
How has language been used to justify this mechanistic view of nature and hence an attack on the natural world starting in the 17th century?
There was a massive amounts of energy put into language reform, again, as a way of defeating the insurgents. In the aftermath of the English Civil War, the English language was cleaned up. And by cleaned up, I mean it was defeminized. And I mean that quite literally, that there were writers who said that they were now writing in a better style because their earlier writings was filled with the frothy imaginings, and, you know, quite explicitly putting down women. There was an attempt to use words with in England, a bishop introduced a bill in the House of Lords to fine preachers using too many metaphors. There was an attempt to make sure, this failed, thank God, that every word had one referent and every referent had one word only. so there would be no synonyms. And all this was in a response to the insurgency, because the insurgency was using poetic language to rouse people up. An eloquent preacher, woman or man, before a crowd can transform that crowd into a force for change. And this was what the authorities, and this was consciously put forth. There was a man in France, Marin Massenne, and the leading thinkers of England who fled from the Civil War gathered with him in Paris every week to talk about philosophy and politics and natural science. And they talked about the need for language reform. And he put forth the notion that you can only use words that had a real referent. So you couldn't talk about unicorns, for example, because they didn't exist. So banish that word. You could not talk about some of the claims of alchemy because they did not exist. So banish that word. The way of writing, where you have a subject and you have a verb and you have a direct object, that particular style of writing came into fashion in this campaign against metaphor and frilly language. And that's happening today as well with the technocratic assault on our language, which is ongoing.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask you. So do you see today then that there's some continuity in terms of the language that we use and its implications for how we see the world in a mechanistic way?
Absolutely. The word technology itself has been totally taken over by the tech realm at this point. Technology is the scissors. It's my eyeglasses. It's my car. It's a ramp leading down to a wharf. Technology is essential to humanity, but now it simply means something that manipulates O's and ones. All these words are being taken over and usurped and simplified. Simplified is the same way that everything is being reduced to an either zero or one. And, that's a truism now. Everyone knows that. But the implications of that are devastating. Because of a zero or one misplaced, a multimillion-dollar mission to Mars was destroyed. Because of a misplaced zero or one, this country has already come within minutes of launching missiles to start World War III. Because of a failure of some of this high tech. And it's ridiculous, it's devastating, it's insane. And to get away with it, the masters, and some of this is conscious, some of this is surely conscious, but then it becomes automatic. The masters have to simplify language.
David, let me ask you about the celebration of nature at the center of a living world that you point to as key to how people saw the world before the rise of capitalism. And you have been arguing against the ways that a particular strain of the Enlightenment instead saw nature as a machine and saw human actions change, all of these things curtailed by mechanistic and reductionistic notion of life. But since you are someone who's very squarely on the left, I wanted to ask you about the embrace of the kind of pre-capitalist worldview, let's call it a pagan worldview, by the fascist right. The Nazis, but certainly not only the Nazis, saw the world, saw nature as having this sort of animated spirit, that they saw nature as vital and that life revolved around what might be termed as a non-rational view of spirit in the world. How do you make sense then of that kind of deeply fascistic and right-wing view of the world? And of course, as you note in your book, Hitler and other leading Nazis saw the occult as an important part of the way they saw the world.
How do I look at it? With terror. in Germany in the 20s and 30s, there was two contending forces, proto-Nazism and communism, coming out of the Weimar Republic. And the communists were very strong, and the Nazis were getting stronger. And the communists did not compete on this terrain of culture and of nature, because that was all, you know, following Marx. Religion was empty. It was a facade. It was stupid. It was a manipulation of the masses. And there are other people besides myself, Ernst Bloch, for example, who says it was devastating to the failures of communism that this was a terrain that they did not compete on. It's a real terrain. The mechanistic view of the world is dead and deadening and anti-human. Of course, in Germany, what happened with the push to industrialize and militarize and to conquer, that stuff of the dialectic and of nature being alive gets pushed out of the way. Not entirely. Both Himmler and Goering were great magicians, believers in magic, and used it in their and what they did in their heinous actions. But largely, the Wehrmacht and industrialization and the building of armaments and tanks took over that understanding of nature as alive and pushed it to the side.
But obviously, for them, even if in the grand scheme of things, the industrial side ended up dominating, there was that strong ideology of a connection, obviously, between blood and soil, which, you know, you don't just see with the Nazis, you can see with fascistic groups and groupings around the world. Certainly in India, the far right also has deep sort of animistic ideas that are entangled with its genocidal worldview. Would you say then that that kind of animistic view of the world, in many ways, while trying to impose instead a mechanical view of the world, leaves one short? But that could it be argued that the animistic view of the world can go left or right, that there's nothing necessarily left about it?
I absolutely agree with one proviso, which is, I think if you look, I'm going to make a wild generalization, but if you look at the right-wing forms of paganism, they're all patriarchal. And it's important, certainly the paganism that I got involved in the 70s and no more the 80s, as part of an activist in the anti-nuclear movement. On the West Coast, a lot of the anti-nuclear movement was pagan-based, and it was all feminist. And the far-right version of this in the Modi and the neo-Nazis in Germany now and the Nazis then were absolutely patriarchal. And I think that makes a major difference. Whether it's a defining difference or not, I'm not sure, but it makes a major difference.
Well, let me end by asking you, what is to be done at this point? So, you know, we find ourselves facing an intense ecological crisis, which has been taking place for a while, but has unfolding around us very visibly, particularly this year, in fact, with floods and fires. We are in a state of emergency, and yet our politics aren't necessarily there at all. And I wanted to know what you think we can glean from the history that you trace. I mean, you're a historian of science rather than someone with a crystal ball here, as far as I know anyway, David. But are there lessons you feel can be applied to the present in seeing the problems with these ways of thinking that have predominated over the past more than three centuries?
Yes, and, you know, believing that that will indeed happen is a huge leap of faith, of course, but miracles happen and societies do collapse and revolutions do happen. But I argue in the book that the simply in terms of the ecological crises facing us, we're not going to get out of them by appointing the committees that think the same way as the committees that have gotten us in the first place. we have to recognize that nature is an active participant with us, not under us, in what we do. And I end the book actually with a kind of imaginary triage system to use for how to pick priorities in what we do in a world that's disintegrating around us, you know, which river basin, which pollutant, which habitat do we throw our energies into? And of course, we throw them into all, but we throw them into all in a different, in different ways. And I think it's going to be vital to think of this as dealing with a nature that is alive and with matter that is alive, and to work with those forces. And the poet Diane De Prima once told me that she knew people who were trying to work on the cleaning up the oceans homeopathically. And I'm enough of a believer in the reality of magic, and having seen it take place time and time and time again in my life, to wonder, maybe there is something in there. The way to intervene in nature using the tools of magic, not in the absence of other interventions, but in alliance with them.
David Krubrin, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sasha. It was great talking to you.
David Krubrin is a historian of science. He is the author of Marxism and Witchcraft. That book is published by Atana Media and at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to it. He curates the Mission Arts and Performance Project. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.